People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Goldmines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Goldmines, where we do what? Say it with me. Get inside the minds of brilliant comedians or comedic talent or people who love the world of funny. That goes from any space, any level. I'm talking writing, directing. I'm talking stand-up comedy. I'm talking about people who love to not only laugh, but to make others laugh. And today's mine, holy shit, we got a fucking great one. We got a legend. And I love that I can say legend. And I love that I can also say friend, real friend. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to welcome Seth Rogen, the Comedy Goldmine. Seth, what's up, man?
What's up, man? That was a great intro. Over that. Oh,
it was fucking great.
You give that a lot, and I appreciate that.
Well, you know, it's like, look, Seth, I can definitely play in the world of, you know, hey, man, I got to give this guy a solid introduction to go down your credits and all of that stuff. But the beauty of this show is, like, you know, it's not really required. You don't need it. It's like, you know, when you know who I'm talking to, it's about the conversation, right? Perfect. It's not about what's been done. It's about what my audience doesn't know that I can then have them walk away from this conversation with a better understanding of.
I hope you're able to do that. You're setting up these expectations, and I hope you're able to make it up.
Kevin, you're setting this up, not me. This is all on you, Kevin.
I wish you luck getting that from me.
Well, here's how I'm gonna start. I'm gonna start off by telling people, man, I've known Seth Rogen for years. Seth was in Los Angeles, let me see here, at the very beginning of my career, before any movies, before any TV, there was the world of Judd Apatow and the relationships that Judd Apatow had became my relationships. And Seth was a very valuable piece to Judd's puzzle. You know, he was not only an actor, he was somebody that found his way into the creative side early on in his career, and I'm talking, this is back when Freaks and Geeks was Judd's show, and Seth was, how old were you at the time, Seth?
I was, when we met, I was like 18 years old, I think, 18 or 19.
18 years old, yeah.
Yeah.
Fucking young, dude.
Yeah.
Do you look back at this and honestly think about how many people we were around at that time in our careers that have blossomed and become, you know, the big stars that they've become?
Yes, very much so. It's crazy. It's wild. And it's nice that so many people went on to do well. And it's not, and it's validating, because I thought that these were funny people, you know, like I thought you were a funny person. And so it was nice to see that you went on to become incredibly successful, because I was always like, oh, Kev's hilarious. And so it was very, in some ways, your success was validating to me, which is all I look for in any situation, is how do I validate myself with this?
You know what I can say, man? I can honestly say that when you look back at James Franco, you look back at you look back at January Jones. You look back at Charlie Hunnam. Charlie Hunnam. You look back at Jay Baruchel. You look back at
Jason Siegel.
God, who else?
Amy Poehler was in that thing that you guys
Amy Poehler, yes.
And that was before, she was, I don't think she was on SNL.
No, Amy, we were all in those beginning stages. Everybody was in those beginning stages. But what struck me like the most about you was at this time when we were really like, you know, in this space, it was how in depth you were from the side of writing, right? Like how did you tap into that? Like what was the segue there? Because, you know, your relationship with Judd, it didn't start out like, okay, well you're gonna also write on this as well. How did you make that segue into being the writer, the young producer early on in your career?
Well, I had done stand-up comedy is where I started when I was like 13. And at the same time, I started trying to write a movie. And that movie became Superbad. But at the time, it was just me and Evan, who you know, like writing down our high school experiences kind of in script form. And it kind of became clear by the time we met that like I was not great at stand-up comedy, nor was it something I was like really passionate about, because I was meeting more and more people like you who clearly were very passionate about it. And I would see the difference in our attitudes about it. And I would just see like, oh, clearly like Kevin, for example, feels a way about this that I don't. Like you wanted to get up all the time. I was more than happy to not perform for large periods of time on end, you know? But I found with writing movies and scripts, I felt like it was something that not a lot of people my age were really pursuing. And I think because of that, I felt like I had like a really strong perspective on it. And and it was also, and we'd been doing it for a long time. So when we met, I had a draft of Superbad that I had been trying to sell, and it ultimately was very close to the movie. So no one wanted to make it, but it was a very good writing sample. And Judd, because of that, hired me as a writer on Undeclared, which was a TV show that he was producing around the time we met. And the way that Judd set up his writers for his TV shows is if you wrote an episode, you essentially were the producer of that episode. And it was kind of like a little movie, and you were in charge of casting it, and you would oversee the shooting of it, and you were kind of in charge of editing it. And through doing that, I got like a real education as to like how to produce things. Basically, you like saw something through from like the very beginning through the like completion of production. And then, how we met was Judd sold this pilot called North Hollywood, and attached to the pilot were like, they sold like three or four scripts or something were a part of the deal. So they were going to shoot a pilot and then have scripts written along with the pilot. And I got hired to write one of those scripts with Jason. So I was kind of like around throughout the shooting of the pilot, the casting of the pilot and the writing of the pilot, because I was like going to be a writer on the show if the show went on to get made, basically. And obviously the hilarious thing that happened, I don't know if you've talked about this, is that I was like very good friends with Jason Siegel. And on the show, you were roommates with Jason Siegel, and Judd made you and Jason Siegel live together in Jason's apartment.
Yes, you had to go. Seth had to go at the time. It was Kevin, go move in with Jason. Yes.
And it was like, you're Jason's new best friend now.
You need to go live with Jason, Kevin, for the sake of this show and the success that we feel it can have. It's going to come down to your chemistry. So the only way for you guys to really get the chemistry that I believe you can is to live together. Okay, Judd. All right. As soon as I get to LA, first thing that I've been tasked with is living with a white man. It was the first thing.
Exactly. And I remember you using a phone book, and this dates the story, to call barbers. You were looking for a barber.
Yes.
You didn't have a barber in LA. I remember
who the fuck is gonna cut my hair? It was the biggest problem.
Exactly.
That was my biggest problem.
And Jason were smoking weed, just watching you go through the phone book, like questioning barbers.
Who the fuck am I gonna call?
Yeah.
Who the fuck am I gonna call, man? So you guys don't know no barbers? No, Kevin. We don't, we no, have no yeah, idea.
Like, where do you guys get your hair cut on?
the mall? Kevin, we go to the mall.
Exactly. I think I did get my hair cut at the mall.
You know what's crazy though, Seth? Like, you know, when you say the way that like you were thrown into the process, right? Like Judd just he gave you not only an opportunity, but you know, he gave you this crash course in a school that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make this very clear, you know, for my listeners, this type of school, this education, it doesn't exist. This isn't how it traditionally happens. You know, you don't meet producers, showrunners that are this generous yeah. within giving the opportunity to not just partner, but to fast track somebody in the world of credit, in the world yeah. of credit and understanding. Standing and Seth, you know, once again, he's talking. Seth was 18. We're talking 18, 19 years old, man. Seth, at some point, right, when you were in this and as it was clicking for you, did you realize that you were going to be able to start the machine of production company, starring and developing my own movies and partnering with studios?
It honestly kind of it came about very organically. Like I was young, so also like I wasn't, and I was having much more success much faster than I thought I was going to in a lot of ways. So mm-hmm. my thinking wasn't instantly geared towards like, how do I do more and more and more? It was more like, this is good. I would like to keep doing this, you know? But what happened was, yeah, is in a very quick period of time, basically we made a 40-year-old virgin in 2004. You were in it. You were there. I remember actually you had a baby the day that you were filming that scene.
Yes. 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 Your fucking memory is great, man. I love it.
Well, that sticks with you as you're like improvising with an actor as they're like looking at their watch because they're like, I'm going to have a baby today.
I think it could be going down, guys. I think there's a chance that I may have this baby today. I remember while we were there. No, it's going to come today.
This is commitment. And then so they made that movie and it came out in 2005. And then we made Knock. And because of that, it did really well. And they were essentially like, we'll make all the scripts you have to Judd. Yep. And what was next was Knocked Up, Superbad, and Pineapple Express. And I had written Superbad and Pineapple Express with Evan. So in one calendar year, we made Knocked Up, Superbad, and Pineapple Express. And they came out over the following 2 years, but they were all produced in one, like one right after the other, one after the other. We were kind of like prepping one as we were shooting the other one, basically, because we also had this attitude of like, who the fuck knows when they're going to stop this? Like, we have to make these. Like, we got to get them out there because like they could just pull the plug on this whole fucking operation at any moment, you know? And then after those came out, it, you know, and they all did very well. It kind of put us in a different position. And that's when in the meantime, we were developing this script called 50-50 that my friend had written. And Judd was developing a similar movie called Funny People that I ended up being in with Adam Sandler. Yep. I think you shot some stuff for that as well.
Yeah, I had a season as well.
And they were kind of similar. So Judd was just like, I can't produce this movie because it has similar ideas in it. And he was like, why don't you just produce it yourselves? And we were like, okay. And it was like a $9 million movie. So it was a good way to start. And that was like the first movie that our production company made. And it like turned out really well. It was profitable for an inexpensive movie. And it became like a very good, we started working with the people that we formed the company with during that movie. And and then it kind of just grew from there, basically.
How did you find Evan? How did you and Evan get together?
We met in bar mitzvah class when we were 12 years old. We literally went to the same synagogue and we met before your bar mitzvahs, you have to like study for it. It's like going to like a confirmation class or some shit like that, you know? And you go to the synagogue like once a week and we were in the same bar mitzvah class. And then what happens is, you go to the bar and bat mitzvahs of everyone in your class. So that year you go to like 50 bar mitzvahs. So essentially every weekend you're at a bar mitzvah. And so every weekend me and Evan found ourselves like at a bar mitzvah. And that's the first time you're like trying to dance with girls and you're stealing sips of alcohol and you're smoking weed. And so we were like, we met during this very like formative time. And then we joined, then we went to high school together right after that. And we started writing Superbad, like right when we went into high school, basically.
Dude, you know what I love? I love that, you know, it's one of those relationships that you can tell is genuine, but it's, I feel like when you have a high level of chemistry, right, in a work relationship, you do the best work because you guys have each other's best interests at hand.
For sure.
And I remember when I was on the set when you guys were doing End of the World.
This is the end.
You guys are doing This is the End. And I remember you guys literally consulting with one another after you were doing like each take. Like, did we get it?
Yeah.
Do you feel like we got it? And you respected what each other had to say. Like there was no I'm the guy and you're not the guy, or you're the guy and I'm not the guy. There was an equal level of we. It was heavy we. And I remember leaving that. And I was so inspired, man. Seth, I never told you this. I was so fucking inspired because I get there and this was like, it was your set. Like you guys were the bosses. I look at the call sheet and remember, this is when I was like, this is when I'm starting to become Kevin Hart. Right? Yeah. I'm at like the height of this stand-up comedy career.
We were thrilled you showed up.
You know, I'm this is when I'm like fucking selling out stadiums and shit. It's going crazy for me. I remember getting there, looking at the call sheet, and it wasn't about the money. I was like, dude, what are you talking about? Absolutely, I'm there. And when I saw all of the names that came in to be a part of this movie, and I saw producers at the top, and it was you and Evan's name and your company's name. And then I saw all of the major actors that you guys had within Jonah, within, Chris, James, you guys had Danny. I mean, you know, I can go down the list of just amazing, talented people. I was like, this is the next level of the business. This is the next stage of the business. And I said, Seth has cracked the fucking code of this stage. He's doing it. And this is the level that I need to be trying to get to. And that's when the producing bug really got turned on for me. That's when the world of Heartbeat Productions and what we now are, that's where it sparked, Seth. It sparked from you and This is the End with you guys being so far, because you had done, like you said, you guys had movies that you had wrote and that you were producers on, but this was like the company.
Yeah.
This was the fucking company. And I was like, this is it for me. This is what I want to do.
Oh,
and you awesome. And Evan did that, man.
Oh, that's so
you
nice.
Fucking
well,
did it.
I should say you're technically the first person I know who had a production company, because when I met you in 2001, you answered your own phone, Heartbeat Productions.
Yeah. And then it's the first thing I learned in LA.
And you go, one second. And then you go, yeah, man, what's up?
Hey, Kev, was that you? Yeah, it was me. Yeah, nope. I was doing this thing, man, where I'm just making people feel like they're calling the office. You know, that's the big thing is perception. That's what I learned exactly. Out here is the perception that people have of you. You wanted
that.
To be in a good place. you said that there was a point, you know, where you realized that you sucked at stand-up comedy. Why so hard on yourself? Why do you feel like you suck?
I didn't suck at it. I honestly was something that's like much even worse than sucking is I was just like pretty good at it. Like I was like, and you probably, you know, I present awards. You've probably gotten a taste of how I was or as a comedian. You know what I mean? Like I'm at the Emmys. I'm at, you know, like it was kind of like that. And it's fine. I'm good for like 1 minute I'm good for. Not like the amount, like I'm good for like four jokes. But honestly, like beyond that, I'm like, I'm fine. I'm not terrible. I'm not, yeah. I'm definitely not great. I would see people who were great and be like, I'm not like that. But I was like, and that was almost the worst thing to be, because I was like, I could keep doing this and be fine at it. But I don't want to do that. It's like, it was a real, and it was good to quit. I'm glad I look at it as like something in my life where I'm like, I'm glad I acknowledged I wasn't as good at it as I would like to be at a thing that I'm doing with my life, you know? Mm.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Did you ever think about hosting anything? Did you ever think about, like, you know, the side of award shows and Seth Rogen, you know, doing the Globes, the Emmys,
again,
the
Oscars?
Again,
I thought about it. I hosted once the Independent Spirit Awards, mm-hmm. and it was actually very funny, I think, like the monologue I gave and the jokes mm-hmm. I gave, and I look back at it, and I think, like, those were very funny jokes, but I also look at it and think, like, I literally could not have done any of that at, like, a mainstream award show. Like, it, like, everything I said was appalling to you know, a mainstream audience. And that's the problem I find, honestly. And it's why, it's like, even the Emmys, like, what I did was so benign, I think, on the grand scale of comedy, and people, like, lost their minds about it.
No, I clearly knew what you were doing and where you were. Like, it was a fucking great bit. You're in a bit. We're in a little tent.
And the Emmys were so mad. And I'm just like, if that gets the mad, if, like, 1 minute of that gets the mad, then, like, I could never host an entire
But you know what's crazy? What's crazy, Seth, is that just shows you the state of comedy and where we are. Right? Like,
well,
like,
I don't find it with, like, I mean, I think for, like, I find with our movies and stuff, we can do whatever the fuck we want. And, like, I'm making a lot of TV shows right now that, like, we can do whatever we want. Like, I think it's just, like, knowing where, I mean, and, like, again, was an award show, like, ever, like, the place that true comedy went to thrive? Like, I
absolutely
don't know.
No.
Like, I think, like, Bill Kimmel singing about, like, Scent of a Woman. Like, that's like sensibility shift. Like, I'm confused why people think award shows have to be relevant. Like, why do they?
Who cares? Well, you know what it is? It's not that people think that. It's that there's loud conversations, and then there's conversations that people just don't have, right? The conversations attached to the award shows and the talent that's participating in them, it's a louder conversation. In other words, meaning it gets press, it gets this stigma because the conversation is loud. But the bulk of people around it, you know, that are moving at a fast pace in this business, it doesn't matter to them. Like, it's not moving the needle to the people that are necessarily moving the needle. It's not like this is a must. And there's this stigma and perception that's been put on a lot of these things as if it is, right? Like you going up and going, yeah, man, this place ain't safe. They got us in a goddamn tent. Ain't no fucking air in here. Y'all said that we would be, it's a bit. You're in a bit. It's funny. Whether you're being truthful with it or not, it's a bit. You're in a funny moment, and that's what people are like. We're forgetting that's the norm. We're forgetting that there's a sense of normalcy and people just going and being funny or being silly or being personable. It's almost as if we're expecting everybody to be on a program all the time, which is kind of odd to me, you know. But it gets tricky. It's a weird conversation because, like,
I have not found, and this is something I say a lot to, like, I've not found at all that I can't say anything I don't want to say personally.
Yeah.
Like, but that could speak to the fact that I have beliefs that are not reprehensible to a lot of people. Yeah. And so I don't get shit for putting my beliefs out into the world. You know what I mean? I think that is, like, the difference, you know, but, like, I've never, you know, I've never even think is this stuff edgy or not edgy. I just genuinely try to make stuff that makes me laugh and that I think makes the audience laugh. And I say, in general, we make movies that are funny and that hit the mark. And I think, you know, like if you look at the last few years of R-rated comedy, I think between Blockers and Good Boys and the things that we've been making, Long Shot, like they're either some of the better ones or some of the more successful ones or both at times. And so I don't know, I'm just speaking for one very narrow section of comedy, and I will say that's like R-rated comedic filmmaking. And I don't find that there's anything we can't do that we used to be able to do.
You don't miss. You don't miss, right? And then you're in your approach to edgy, you're not doing the let's be edgy to create these shock factors.
Yeah.
Right? You're doing relatable edgy. You're doing shit that people can identify and understand because they've either done it, they know somebody that's done it, or they've been around people that talked about doing it, right?
Yeah.
It's all off of experiences. It's all off of grounded real moments in life. And when you bring up Good Boys, I mean, I don't think there's a funnier movie, right? When you talk about Good Boys and you talk about these kids and you talk about how you guys really tapped into the world of vulgar and involving kids, well, that's real. What do you think kids do? I found my son's group chat in his phone. I've never seen more curse words in my life.
But I think like that's the exact type of thing that most people would be like, oh, like you can't be funny anymore. And then it's like, we are a movie where it's like 12-year-olds saying like literally the grossest shit like you could imagine, and people are fine with it. Like a select, you know, it gets good reviews, it makes a lot of money. Like, and if that isn't a good barometer for people being fine with something, like I don't know what is. So I think like, do you find there are things you wish you could? Are you writing down things that you're crossing out because you're just like, the world's not ready for this?
No. The bad part for me is, you know, I've talked about this several times on the podcast, where I struggle and where I have to be careful is, you know, I've built this brand, right? And
the Kevin Hart
within
brand.
The brand, the brand of myself, the brand of company, but now there's people that are underneath this umbrella, right? And these people that are underneath this umbrella, well, they work for me, they work with me. And I just have to be mindful of my actions because I don't want my actions to affect their reality. And that's what I have to be careful about. And that's what I'm mindful of, right? Because, you know, the thing that I may go, man, I don't give a fuck about that. That's stupid. Like, y'all get out my goddamn face. And I carry on with whatever stubborn moment, whatever stubborn move. If this is something that, you know, is deemed bad and consequences come in from it, well, I can survive the consequences. I'll be okay. But the people around me, they can't. And I gotta make sure that I don't think about it in a way as if they can. So that's where I'm just extremely mindful. And not to the point of like crossing shit out, just to the point where I'm just aware. I'm more aware today than I ever was. I remember you going on your on Twitter. This is when, you know, just like it was just a racial moment, right? Where people were just really, really just trying to embrace this world of hate, especially, you know, based on color. And I remember you going on social media, and he was like, hey, if you're a person that follows me, and if you think like this, then I don't want you fucking follow me. And, you know, people started saying shit and you just start going off on people. Well, fuck you too. Hey, you know what? You eat a dick. Yeah, well, get the fuck off my page. And I mean, if people only knew you, they would know that that's really who you are. you weren't doing that as a bit. You were being serious because at the end of the day, Seth Rogen, yes, he loves what he does, but Seth Rogen is very much Seth Rogen. He's him. And that person that he is, he's never allowed others to question how good of a person he is because he knows it. And if anybody around him, you know, if your morals aren't right, or if you're just a person that's kind of out of line or out of order, you've always been the guy that will fuck you or fuck this guy. You've never not been that guy, right? Never. And I love that about you. I love that about you, man.
I appreciate that. I wish it was hard to really, I get like, it's like, I enjoy doing it. So it's not, it's something I feel weird getting praised for because it's a true pleasure to be totally honest. But I do think when you, and I'm sure this is something that you can relate, like, I think when you are a famous person, and I'm sure like people are always kicking the tires on you because, especially when you're a comedian, because I think one of the things people are buying into is your perspective. Like, I think it's different than with actors who don't write their own material or performance themselves because, like, you know, whatever, I could think like, whoever, but I'll pick someone, you know, I could think like Adrian Brody's like the worst human. I've never met him, I should say. I could think he's the worst guy ever, but I love his performance. And so, like, truthfully, I find myself watching Mel Gibson movies. I find him reprehensible as a human. But, like, but I'm not buying into who Mel Gibson is as a person. I am buying into his ability to perform, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But with a comedian, you are buying into who they are as a person and their perspective on the world. And I think that's why people are kicking the tires on comedians maybe more than other types of performers, because they want to know if it's okay to be buying into their perspective and enjoying it. And I think that's something I find with myself is people, you know, want to laugh at me and want to laugh at my films and the things I write and the things I put out, but they want to be like, okay, but just like every little while, we got to make sure that like we're all on the same page here, because if we're not, I don't know if you're someone whose perspective I want to be indulging in necessarily. And it's not because of my ability to perform or be funny or anything like that. It's because with comedy specifically, I think you kind of have to like the person for lack of a better thing. And I think that is something that comedians I see out there publicly reacting to in very weird ways when they just start to become someone that maybe people don't like as much as they used to. And that becomes very upsetting to them, you know? And I think like that's a thing that maybe people just need to be like, oh, maybe I am acting in a way that's less likable, or maybe my views are just less likable and I should accept that, and I shouldn't expect the same reaction when I'm being less likable, you know?
I talked about, man, and I've said this a couple of times, then, and I wish that this quality would come back. People have forgotten that it's okay to not be a fan.
Yeah, and to not have fans.
They've forgotten. People have forgotten that it's okay. Like, it really is okay to say, you know what? That person isn't for me. Yeah. It's okay. Like, it's not a bad thing if you have that feeling. And for some reason in today's time, people that have that feeling feel like they have to persuade others to share the same feeling.
But I find respectively comedians who are alienating large groups of who might be their audience are acting like some unreasonable inquisition is being held against them, when simply what is happening is they've said things that people find to be reprehensible, which is fine. And they're acting like there's some cultural upheaval targeted at them, when simply what has occurred is they've lost fans because of what they said.
Well, it's the world of disagreeing, right?
Yeah.
Did I say that word right, Seth? Is it
disagreeing? Disagreeing's a word, disagreeing. I think. Yeah.
Yeah, disagreeing. I don't know what the fuck I said, but I don't think it was right.
I'm not an educated man.
When people hear it, I just want you to know I called myself on it. So don't think I'm that
disagreeing
bad.
Disagreeing is a word.
Okay. So what I think is happening here is this, right? Here's my take on it. You tell me what you think.
Yeah.
If I did say something, and if I did possibly, let's just say trigger, let's use the word trigger, right? If I said something and it triggered said feeling in individual or individuals, right? And I said it, and those individuals go, well, you know what? We don't like what you said. Those individuals have every single right to feel a way about me as a talent and to not want to support my talent. Right. And when those individuals speak out and say that they don't like me and my talent, well, now as the talent, I have a choice to either accept that what I said acted as a trigger and understand that and go, okay, well, maybe I just, you know, will refrain from doing that because I don't want to trigger anybody. I don't want to upset anybody because that's not what I'm doing, what I do for. But if there's any type of misunderstanding or if there's any type of miscommunication, well, I also have the choice to try to communicate correctly. In today's time, we're not finding a middle ground, right? Like nobody is okay with finding the solution. Everybody's okay with the problem. Nobody's okay with the solution, Seth. And that to me, that's where the problem occurs, right? Because, you know, we can talk about Chappelle, you know, what Chappelle is doing now in his last special. It's more about being focused on the problem and not solution. And I see people buying past the attempt to find solution and solely focusing on the problem.
But that is well within people's rights. Like if you're saying something that you know is probably going to be really offensive to a lot of people, mm-hmm. and then those people are very offended by it, you as the sayer of these offensive things are then insane to act like there is something amiss with that dynamic because you knew that was what was going to happen.
And well, you take that, you know the risk that
right,
comes
yeah,
with saying.
Yeah, like if I say something right now, let's say I wasn't a Jewish person, and right now I'm like, you know what, fuck Jews, fuck them.
Whoa.
And like, and so, you know, and then Jews got mad about that. I was like, look, Jews, this is my opinion. Settle down. I'm a comedian. I'm wrong in that situation. You know what I mean? But I can say it. No one's going to legally stop me from saying it. Mm-hmm. And just like no one is legally stopping any comedian from saying anything, I don't think ever. And I say this as one of the few comedians on earth to actually have their material like pulled down. Basically, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. very few comedians had a piece of work that started that caused the controversy that the interview did to the point that it literally like there was threats of violence against.
I was literally going to bring that up. I mean, you talk about being in it. I mean, of course, we're no strangers to it, myself included. You know, we've both been and some of the heaviest, I guess you say, pieces of turmoil.
Yeah, but to that end, I don't look at what happened with that and think, I'm like, yeah, we made a very controversial film where we assassinate a world leader and controversy ensued. Like that, it makes sense to me. And it's not something I get mad about. And it's not something I complain about. And I think that's mostly what I see with comedians. Honestly, and I would reduce it to that in a lot of ways, is they just seem, a lot of comedians just seem to be complaining that people are offended by their offensive jokes. And it's that simple to me. And as someone who's offended a lot of people throughout their career, if I think that they are not right to be offended, I don't complain about it. And if I think that they are right to be offended, I have to think like, okay, do I stand by that? Did I not understand what I was doing? Should I apologize? Or do I feel like, you know what, fuck it. But one way or another, it's like, you know what you're doing. And so why get so upset about it? Like, I don't, that to me is like, that's mostly where I get lost in the conversation is like, it's become this thing. I hear so many comedians talking about, we can't make the jokes we used to make. We can't say the stuff we used to say. And I'm just like, it's like, so, oh, your job is hard? Who fucking cares? Everyone's job's fucking hard. Make fun of your fucking jokes and don't appall people. I'm sorry. Now that's part of your job. If you want that, if you don't want to be known as someone who appalls people, and if you don't care, then just make your fucking jokes and you will continue to do it. You can be a very successful comedian touring the country saying the worst shit ever on stage on a nightly basis if you want, you know? Like, you just can. And so, like, that, I mostly don't get what people are complaining about, honestly.
Well, you're solution-based.
Yeah, I guess I am. Well, or the answer is just like comedians complain that people like complaining about their jokes and causing this friction and this turmoil, I would say that it seems like a lot of comedians like to do the exact same thing. And they like to complain about people complaining about their jokes and add to that turmoil of that conversation, you know?
Well, we're living in a very negative time, Seth.
I try to keep it positive, Kevin.
Negative time, right? So being positive in this time, it's a rare quality. It's one that most don't have.
Is it a hard time to be a comedian? Is that a thing? Like, do you genuinely think that? Do you look at what we're doing and you're like, man, the lot of the comedian is so hard right now? Like, do you
No, think I don't. I don't think it's. I don't think it's hard. I think that it is a. I think for the first time, you know, a comedian is looked at the same way that a politician is, which is weird, right? Like it's not like that line was always far apart. It was always far apart. But today, the same attention that a politician gets when they speak, comedians, depending on the comedian, depending on the stature, you know, it's attached to the comedian, can get the same attention, right? So as a comic where once upon a time, you know, you making jokes about whatever, political, you know, life, whatever, it didn't grab the attention of those masses. It had the attention of the people, but you never really crossed over there. It never became a conversation. I think today, in today's time, it is. Right? Like, you know, everything that's said when you have that microphone in your hand, well, it can be taken and it can be, you know, I don't want to say used against you because that's the wrong intent. But everybody can say, well, I heard when you said this and when you said that, I thought it was this.
I can see that. I see how the nature of being a comedian has changed in that way. And for sure think that as someone who makes movies, I think that was always the filter I was putting my work through. Mm-hmm. Is like, would the masses be appalled by this? and is this reprehensible to the masses? Because I think when you make movies, you know that it is forever and that a lot of people are going to see it probably, you know what I mean? And I guess maybe as a comedian, there used to be some coverage in knowing that maybe you were just saying it one night and hopefully not a lot of people were hearing it if it was a fucked up thing.
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Here's a question for you, right? When you talk about the interview and we talk about that time, by the way, you know, I was caught up in that shit with you.
Yeah, you were everyone who had ever worked for the Columbia Pictures Corporation. Yes.
The emails and all that shit. I remember getting a call and it was like, hey, you see what's going on? The fucking, with the interview where they hacked all Sony's emails, Kev, you're in it. And I was like, of course I am. I remember just going, of course, why wouldn't I be? Why wouldn't this be something else? When that hit, was there like a moment where, you know, I call it like the oh fuck moments, right? There's a moment when you're in some shit and you're by yourself and you just sit down and you really process what the fuck is going on. You kind of just, oh fuck, you oh fuck yourself. Yeah. Was there a moment where you sat down, you know, in quiet, it's just you, and truly realized the magnitude of what was happening?
Yeah, there was a lot of them, and it kept escalating. There was a moment I did that very early on, and then it kept getting worse from there, and I kept having more and more oh fuck moments. And I mean, I thought, like, there was a moment where, like, literally, like, Obama was giving, like, an entire press conference dedicated to it for, like, half an hour, 45 minutes or something. like it was moments like that where I was just like, Jesus Christ. Like, and It was huge. It was far beyond anything that I had experienced or that anyone I'd known who worked in movies had experienced. It never happened. It became the biggest news story a movie ever had, as far as like wading into political controversy.
There's never been a movie to go through anything like this. There never will be another. Right? It'll never happen again.
They would deal with it differently now. They would use ours as a test case to be like, we shouldn't do that.
at some point though, was there like a, oh fuck, like, yo, we could definitely be in position to like get hurt. Like this is getting to the point where I don't know if we're safe anymore.
Yeah,
right?
They gave us like 24 hour, they gave us like armed security, Sony did. And then one day just took it away from us, which was also hilarious.
They just removed it.
Yeah. I was worried a crazy American person might kill me. Honestly, that was my fear. Like I wasn't worried about North Korea, genuinely. I was worried some insane local would think they were like doing the world a favor by taking me out, and it's still a fear I generally have in my life. I did have a fear that it would ruin my career ultimately. Was a fear I had, that like,
wow,
people just didn't want to bother, wouldn't want to bother working with me, or would think that I was like, was I funny anymore after that? Like, was I just like involved in something that was so fucked up that like it just would like taint my work forever?
You never spoke out like in that. You never took the stance of fuck everybody, this is stupid, right? You never took that stance. I think the one thing that you did that was public, it was when you hosted SNL after, and I remember watching, because I was like, you know, what's the angle that he's going to take? That was a big thing. Like,
yeah,
you know, you can't do the world and road of not address it at all. They got to say something. And what's the approach to saying something? And I think when you and Franco did, you know, the monologue was so clear and clean. You know, the guest that you guys had interacting with you when you did it, you kept it light and you kept it personable, and you look poised. That's what I remember saying. Like,
that was
in the thick of it, you looked fucking poised. Like, you know, it is what it is.
We exuded confidence.
Yes, your shoulders were sitting up, and I was like, you know, if you go out there and you look like a fucking hit dog, well then people are going to do things to make you holler. But you definitely had your head held high through it all.
Yeah, and then what was funny is I was making this Steve Jobs movie, like it all happened in December, and then in January I was in San Francisco and I was working with Kate Winslet, and like she like leaned over to me and was like, did something happen with you recently in the news? And I instantly was just like, oh yeah. Like, also no one gives a fuck about anything that doesn't directly involve them on a very like day-to-day basis. And people like instantly forget about this shit. And like a month later, it was as though it never happened. People bring it up, like in the, you know, people ask about it, but it's not like, we're not like these like pariahs who like, you know, almost got everyone killed. And it was like, oh, as soon as that happened, I was like, oh yeah, no one gives a shit. Like it's totally fine.
I think it's very important to just to understand that you survived, right?
Yes.
Like that's a big deal, because
for sure,
you know, people fold.
We just kept working. We did not stop working. That was, I think, like a huge part of it, is like we just kept filming things. Like we kept directing, I kept acting, and like we didn't give people a chance to like I believe in momentum a lot. I'm sure you do too, as someone who never literally stops doing things. And like I don't have a lot of like philosophies in life, but I do believe in momentum, and I think like mm-hmm. I think like when you have it, you keep it, and once you lose it, it's hard to get it again. And
absolutely.
I think I've been in like a constant state of momentum since 2004 that I've been afraid to stop in some ways. And I do think that like a large part of why we recovered from the interview was just like, we just kept working. You couldn't say that it was going to hurt our career because it already hadn't. We had already filmed three things by the time that thing was happening. You know what I mean? And so it just kind of kept, shit just kept coming out. And so like it kind of answered its own question of like, will this stop us? And it was like, no, it didn't. We just kept doing shit, you know?
If anything, it gave you more. If anything, it gave you more confidence.
For sure. And it made me see, like, it also made me look at a lot of the things that, again, comedians kind of talk about being embroiled in controversy. And I'm just like, that's not controversy. Like, we had a real controversy, you know?
their life isn't being threatened.
Yeah. Like, a foreign power with nuclear weapons isn't personally threatening you. Then it's not real controversy.
when I tell you, I remember, like, you just said, like, you know, Obama was giving a press conference about it, right? And that's your big moment. For me, I mean, Jesus Christ, I remember when CNN, you know, when the shit happened with the Oscars, and I'm watching CNN, I was the first story.
Yeah, man, exactly.
On CNN, and I remember going, holy shit.
Aren't you glad you didn't host the Oscars ultimately? Do you look back at that and think, like, thank God?
I am, Seth, because, it, I mean, you know, if I'd have done it, what's the win that I'm getting?
That's, you know, always, like, that's always what I'm asking myself when I see people hosting award shows is like, what are you getting from this?
Yeah, like it's after there's no world where I can or could have stepped on that stage and it wouldn't have been about that.
Yeah.
Right? Like it wouldn't, like there's no world where the performance would be highlighted or celebrated or embraced because it would all be about that. And that's the only thing of like, damn, like, you know, because in doing it, you know, if there was a world where it's like, okay, well, we've gotten past that, right? Like, you know, I show that I was a adult. I show that, you know, I was aware of where I made mistakes, where I was wrong, where I came off cocky, ego-driven, and, you know, quickly made the changes and corrected it to show, hey, like I'm genuinely sorry for the way that I handled this situation. And even though this was years ago and I felt like I addressed it then, I should have addressed it again. I should have taken a different stance than the one that I did and been a little more mature. I've done that. I found a solution. Even with that being said, there's no world where I can step on that stage and that's not brought up again. Like it's just, there isn't. So that's the only reason, you know, why I wouldn't do that. Now, is there a different version of something else that could present itself? Who knows? You know, is it one of those shows, Emmys, Globes, or some shit like that down the line? Who knows? But yeah, for that particular chapter, that door is closed. You know what I mean?
I feel like the SNL opening monologue is maybe one of the last, like, things for a comedian to really create like a cultural moment that actually everyone pays attention to for a brief moment.
That's actually a great segue. How do you feel about SNL today? Like, you know, when you look at the show, right? It's like, you know, does it still carry the same weight that it once did? And is it the same for everybody? Because, you know, it's like, we love Lauren. We love all of the writers and the talent that's a part of that show. And, you know, there's moments where SNL is going to have a high volume of eyeballs, like Kim Kardashian just doing it.
Yeah.
And the monologue that she just did. It got a huge,
funny,
huge fucking traffic,
jokes,
right? And was good. And for that right there, you go, holy shit, SNL still can do it, right?
Yeah.
But it depends on the person that's there. Do you feel like it's still the same bang for you, like come movie time? Do you feel like it's a must?
Oh, I haven't hosted SNL. I honestly couldn't tell you the last time I hosted Saturday Night Live. I think maybe.
Would you do it? Like, if they asked you to do it again, would you do it again?
I would do it again because I enjoy it. I think it's fun. I don't necessarily, I've seen no correlation between like doing SNL and my movies being successful that come out after them. You know what I mean? I've for sure been in a lot of movies that have failed in the wake of me hosting Saturday Night Live. But I enjoy it, and I love Lorne, and I love like the institution of it. And I do, if anything, I am still amazed at how relevant it manages to be using a mechanism that was created decades ago and essentially hasn't changed. And if anything, like, it speaks in a fascinating way to me to like the timelessness of a good idea, like, and how some things, even with social media and all that, like, it still works. It almost works mm-hmm. better than anything in our era of like immediacy, because it's live, you know. And it really, like, if anything, I look at it, yeah, and I'm like, this shit still holds up, and like they're still getting a lot of eyeballs on it. The way they do it is the same as it's been. Literally, the same people are doing. They use fucking cue cards still, and it like still manages to capture the attention of an audience that's it's hard to catch people's attention for these days. You know what I mean? So
it's one of those things where you look back and you say, this is the longest running show, you know, in TV, right? And it's going to go down in history as one of the longest. And when you look at Lorne, I think what impresses me the most is that he's actually there.
Yeah.
Right? Like he's actually there.
And as to why he's there, it's something I think of almost more than anything as a general piece of advice when it comes to making things. Once I asked, because you know he walks through the floor throughout the whole show, mm-hmm. And like kind of stalks around the audience. And I was once like, why do you do that? And he went, I like to let the audience know they're in good hands. And I was like, that's actually like, And when we make movies, it's something we talk about so much, is like, how do you make it that like within the first few minutes of the movie, the audience knows they're in good hands and they can just relax. Wow. They aren't worried. Like, is this a good movie? Is it funny? Like, they just know, like, you're in good hands. We got you. We took care
strong.
Of it. Don't worry about it.
That's strong.
And it's something that is from Lorne. But the truth is, I think the best, I think the best SNL hosts are not people who are funny. Like, I think that is what is most exciting for people. And it's why people like Kim Kardashian, to me, she's like the perfect SNL host. It's like someone who you don't associate with being hilarious, and you support them with a team of writers and comedians and brilliant improvisers and impressionists. And you make them funny, you know? Mm-hmm. And to me, like, something I felt sometimes is just like, I don't know if this is how people want to be seeing me necessarily. It's like, is this funnier than one of my movies? I don't know if it's funnier. It's maybe as funny, like, potentially, but it's not like, I don't know if this is the format that people are begging to see me in necessarily. I enjoy
doing
it.
It's about coming out of there, though. It's about coming out of there with just one. If you can come out of SNL from all of your times doing it, if you're fortunate enough to get to that point where you host it and you host multiple times.
Yeah.
If you can get out of SNL with one like legendary sketch that you know people will go back to and go, remember when such and such did, then that's mission accomplished. I think I've hosted
SNL maybe four. I honestly don't know. I've hosted maybe four times and then been like a little.
You got to have one. I promise you have one. You got to have one.
I don't know, but
you probably have one. You may be pushing two. For me, I know mine's a Z shirt. Is it a Z shirt? It was like that crazy.
What
like,
year was that?
Oh my God. Fuck,
also, like, I just feel so old every time I go there now. Where I'm
no, we're
like,
up there.
I just feel so incredibly old.
What are you
old.
Talking about? Look at us. You at least you wear your gray. I keep trying to fight mine. I dye mine. I keep trying to dye it. This
don't do
gray.
That,
I start looking like Morgan Freeman. It's bad for me.
No, you, just enter it. Just enter
listen,
me, gold.
Seth, if you see me with gray hair, you might think I'm sick. You might go, holy shit, Kev's got it. You won't even know what you're referring to. You'll just say, I got it. Whatever
do you look funny? Do you look funny?
Yeah.
Have you let it
Man,
happen?
I just look old. I look old as fuck with gray hair. It's bad.
You suddenly look like Kevin Hart doing a character. Yeah. Are you playing an old guy in something?
We... before we get out, before we wrap anything up, you know, you and I, we fumbled the ball, and you know, we were going to do a movie together, and then my fucking schedule, I was like, I'm going to do this project, I can't do this one. It was like one of those weird things where decisions had to be made, the development. I was like, Seth, this is going to take long. I got to make the better decision. This is a bigger movie. And by the way, it ended up being that. It ended up being a good decision because it just helped propel. But you and I have yet to get down on this big screen. We've yet to fucking find the thing that allows us to get down. And that thing, it can't be the cop. You can't be a cop. I can't be a detective. We don't want to do that, Seth. We've been on all fronts of those movies. But when I tell you there is an opportunity,
I would love it
for you and I to fuck people up, and not necessarily with the crazy funny slap slick. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about with the character driven content that's based off of two real people, right? Two real fucking people. Seth, we have to crack the code.
I know.
I've checked so many boxes, and we've been around each other throughout our entire career.
We've worked together in very brief increments, but
we have yet to truly get down.
You replaced me with The Rock.
we have to crack the code, man. We both sit at the top of two very successful production companies. We have two amazing teams, and I think that we should task our teams, you know, with the idea of, you know, you and I doing something. We need to do something, and I don't give a shit, you know, what or how, but I'm saying it on record, and I love to say things on record here because it's almost like the verbal contract.
So you're
held to it. And then if you see me later, you're like, Kev, what the fuck happened? You say I'm full of shit. Kevin's full of shit. He said all that. I sent him three scripts. He told me to go fuck myself every time. He's a liar. You can say that, but you can't, because it wouldn't
now
be the
I
case,
can.
Man. We definitely have to make it a priority. We have to do something together before it's all said and done, man. We just have to.
I'm in, Kev. Let's do it.
That's all I need to hear. That's all I need to hear.
We both work. We're both working. We might as well do it together.
Why not? Seth, this show, man, is really a hobby. It's a hobby for me, man. And what I love the most about it are the dope moments of dialogue and truth, right? Where through the relationships that I've been able to, you know, develop over my course of time in this business, there's so many moments that, you know, people just aren't aware of. And you and I going through memory lane just now, just talking about the roommate situation, me looking for the fucking barber, you know, when I had to live with Jason, you know, your world and road to becoming the producer that you are, you incentivizing me to start a production company.
I actually got to send you these pictures that I have of us at Jason Siegel's apartment with, it's me, you, and I think January Jones and Jason Siegel and Judd is there and Amy Poehler and Will Arnett, and we're literally smoking like a 1 foot long joint I remember
you wrote that. I remember that was like your biggest project.
Yeah,
your biggest fucking project was completing this fucking 12-foot. It was a 12-foot joint.
I have photos from that night. I'll send them to you.
You have
someone
to, man.
Sent them to me recently.
Seth, this show is about getting inside the minds of brilliant comedians and brilliant people that embrace the world of funny, man. And you are every bit of that, dude. I can say genuinely, I'm a fan. I'm a friend. And dude, I love what you've been able to accomplish, and I love the fact that you're still you. You're still true to you, man. And I truly do hope that my audience you know, takes away your level of honesty, your transparency, and just how you consistently are, man. It's just what makes you dope as fuck. It's why you have the fan base that you have, and why you just continue to succeed. It's because you're all around good dude, man. And I got to thank you once again for coming on Comedy Gold Mines. This was everything I thought it would be, plus more.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Oh, man. Thanks for being on. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Comedy Gold Mines. You just got inside the mind of Seth Rogen, goddammit. Don't forget it. And don't forget where it happened at. I'll see you next time. Peace.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.